Hello, everyone. You are listening to the Regenerative by Design podcast, where we will be getting to the root of health, climate, economics, and food. I am your host, Joni Kinwall Moore. I'm an RN, an ethnobotanist, and the founder of Snacktivist Foods. Join me on this journey as we explore the ideas, stories, and personalities behind the regenerative food system movement. Food is the connection between people and planet. In a world where pandemics, climate change, and war have made us feel so disconnected and vulnerable, regenerative agriculture has become a powerful force for positive transformation and hope. Here, regenerative thought leaders share how agriculture and food design can create a more resilient system. Hello, and welcome to the Regenerative by Design podcast, where we aim to get to the root of health, climate, economics, and food. And today I have an awesome guest. I'm very excited. A friend of mine by the name of Tim Corney, who is a farmer in Buell, Idaho. And he's doing some really incredible future forward things in agriculture and in food. And today he's going to tell us a little bit about his story. But I think it's really intriguing to know where people come from and what makes them come to these realizations that there's a little bit more to life than what meets the eye. And I know Tim's got a really cool story of how he came to be an organic and regenerative farmer in Buell, Idaho. So Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
And I would love for you to tell us a little bit about your background. Like, how did you get to be the Tim Corney that I know today?
Well, I started off as a conventional farmer years ago. I started farming in 91, and my dad was a conventional farmer, and I thought that's the way it was supposed to be. And then my dad ended up getting Parkinson's, and he died of Parkinson's. It gave him cancer, and I think it had to do with residual chemicals. Mm-hmm.
What year was that?
He died 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. My son got tuberous sclerosis, which is benign tubers in the brain, and mm-hmm. he's got one behind the heart and behind the eye. And you know, when I was young, we handled Sonalan, Tam, and stuff like that with the beans, and then used
what kind of chemicals are those? Just so our listeners.
Well, they were bean chemicals, and then they weren't working because every year I think other farmers were adding another pint, thinking it was going to get weed control, and then mm-hmm. And then you're handling 2,4-D and spraying weeds. You got this backpack, and it splashes, and it gets on your deal. And and I was giving a talk to a group, and I said, I can smell 2,4-D, and I can taste it on my tongue.
I remember the smell and taste of that.
Yeah.
It's very distinctive.
You're very distinctive. And so you smell it, but here I am, I've been organic farming for 14 years, and, and maybe 15 years. Mm-hmm. And so here I go all that far back, and then if I smell it, I can taste it. And so what was that in my DNA? Did I genetically alter my son's health?
Right.
And don't know.
Right.
And so, these are hard questions. And
they are.
And we've talked about the cancer belts along the mm-hmm. There's some huge cancer belts and the mm-hmm. runoff of chemicals and fertilizers and insecticides and we had a neighbor kid who got pancreatic cancer and he died. And then, there's people with tumors
seeing it firsthand.
I'm seeing it firsthand. And, they built a brand new St. Luke's cancer ward over there. And you drive by and the parking lot's full, they're getting their treatments and stuff like that.
Wow.
So,
and there aren't that many people down there.
They're flying in too, because they put up a hell of a deal. But the thing is, though, we have gotten out of bounds. We have mm-hmm. gone too far the other way. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, though, when you start looking biologically on how the soil works, all wealth and health comes from soil. And so, when you look at the rainforest or the redwoods and you see all that massive growth, that was biological activity from leaves and bugs and whatever mm-hmm. that did its magic. And so we're mimicking that farming. And and Kurt, my cousin, and I are partners, and we bought a Pillsbury plant in Buell, Idaho, and we're able to haul our commodities right from the field there, clean it, and color sort it, and mm-hmm. package it, and then go into the retail stores, and so we're able to handle it one time.
Yeah.
And so we're not having all this trucking across the country thing. Mm-hmm. And so, and we're big on soil health and biology. You know, we're running sheep, we're putting in cover crop, we're putting kale and tillage radish and peas and
we're nourishing
it. Right. And, you know, Gabe Brand said something one time, there's more nitrogen in the atmosphere sitting over a grain bin full of nitrogen prills, you know, the fertilizer, than what's in that tank. And he's absolutely right.
Jesus.
You know, and so you can naturally pull that nitrogen from the atmosphere with the right kind of cover crop and put that nitrogen nodules.
That's what plants are good at.
That's what they're for.
And the fungi that help fix that nitrogen. But
yeah,
boy, you know, it's so fascinating where you come from. You know, being from a very conventional, and often if you're taught to be a conventional farmer, and then you're looking to do something differently than your dad did, there could be a lot of pushback for that.
Well, you sometimes can't go to the coffee shop. You get ridiculed, you know, and because you think differently, and then they believe you can't feed the world with organic farming. But the bottom line is we're the unhealthiest we've ever been in the United States, and we're creating bulk, cheap food that has no nutritional value. And we're using them as fillers, and we're using too many chemicals. And I'll tell you another little adventure that I had. I had my daughter in 4-H, and I had a guy there that was there, and he was German, and so he was there and kind of stranded, and I said, well, here, take. I got an extra pickup, and I got an extra house. I said, just take this pickup and go. Drive everywhere you want to go see and do. And
that's amazing, by the way.
Yeah. And I had this extra house.
Guy from Germany.
Yeah. And
here's the keys.
Yeah. He's one of the high end horse trainers in Germany right now and works with a lot of, and he has a horse ranch over there. And so he was so grateful for what, you know, and we became good friends. He wanted me to, he said, you come over to Europe and I'll take you anywhere you want to go.
Nice.
And so I learned so much from him. You know, he was born behind the communist wall, and when the wall came down, he was able to travel to India, Brazil, all over the world, and he had a whole different perspective on things. Mm-hmm. And he was heavy in the food industry as far as chefs and high-end stuff. And so when you go to Europe, their beer is amazing. They don't want any preservatives in their food. It's natural. Mm-hmm. And so he said, Tim, he goes, we're sitting there in the parking lot, and he goes, see all these restaurants over here? He goes, that food's dead. Our food's alive.
Mm-hmm.
And he was basically saying we put so many preservatives, so much sugar, the way we process our food.
Just nuke it.
And he says over there, you know, when you go over to Germany and you eat their bread, if you throw
totally it on, different experience.
Totally different experience. It's a meal and goat cheese and the whole thing. When you lay that bread on that table, if you don't eat it in 3 days, it starts to mold.
Yeah.
Because it's alive, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how they look at food. Mm-hmm. And so...
And they have a legacy of organic farming and biofarming.
Yes.
And permaculture.
Yes.
It's just a different mindset.
Well, and it was beautiful for me, you know, to have that experience, you know. Yeah. And so I was...
Remind me of the year that was.
That was in 2014.
Okay.
And I actually wanted to go to Ukraine. And I was... Because they have unbelievable, massive, super great soil. And I wanted to see that. And then Putin was beaten on the door out there with the war at that time.
Yeah.
So then I ended up sleeping in the back of a van. We had a diesel van with a bed in it, and I traveled all through Germany and France and Spain and Switzerland and Austria. And
what a great adventure!
Yeah, I went over to Morocco and came back, and I had amazing eating experience. Amazing, I met phenomenal people, very very intelligent,
and the
bright
food
people.
Culture is just radically different.
Way different. Mm-hmm. And also they had robotic technology. You know, they have these little robots that push feed up on the dairy cows, and all the dairies are around 300 cows mainly.
Mm-hmm.
And they have an M1 or a Lely robotic milker that'll come in there and clean the teats and then automatically milk them. And then
it's all like technology driven.
Yeah, no one's there. Them cows come in, they get milked, and they walk in and milk themselves, and then go out, and it's just So they have a really a lot of animal husbandry, and so I just had such a great experience when I came back. I was telling Kurt, I said, Kurt, you know, we got to quit feeding cattle and start feeding people.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
that's a good line.
And so Kurt, my cousin, is a sharp kid, and he agreed. And so we decided, okay, let's pull our resources here and let's make this happen. And we were really fortunate to be able to pick up a huge facility. We can load 5 rail cars at a time and
yeah,
five
fantastic.
Unloading docks. Yeah. You know, we got a lot of power.
And it's right there.
Right there. And so yes. you couldn't beat a better system that we got. Mm-hmm. And so, so here we are and we're trying to make a meal replacement bar that is super healthy. The only sugar in it is actually honey, raw honey is a binder to it. Mm-hmm. And it meets all your nutrient requirements. And because a lot of these meal bars are candy bars.
Oh, yeah.
And so, Starbridge. Yeah. So we really came up with one. We have a gal by the name of Amber who can, she's like Beethoven, you know, she just has this natural ability. She came from a cow camp in Battle Mountain, Nevada, and she can just cook like wow. you can't believe. And so she's our research developer.
That's cool.
Yeah. And so we're working with some of these ancient corn, and bees go crazy in ancient corn. And so we're big about bees.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize that. I mean, my guess is most people listening to this podcast probably are aware of that. But what do you notice as a farmer between like your, you know, heritage, old world, organic corn, or when you walk into one of these huge mega monocrop cornfields?
Well, I know it sounds weird, but I got a lot of ducks that mob my fields that don't go to the neighbors. So, you
wow.
know,
wow.
so if that means anything, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they circle my fields, but I don't know what that means. But we're really bee friendly. Our pheasant population's really expanded, you know, mm-hmm. and because
CC life growing.
Yeah, yeah, but we're planting sunflowers and we're planting flowers and we're putting mm-hmm. buckwheat behind crops because it that's a kind of a natural thing to help bring the phosphate available with buckwheat to the next crop and the bees like need the mm-hmm. you know when it's flowering. So
yeah,
I feel like we're really on the right path and mm-hmm. you're always learning. I mean, we don't have this thing dialed in 100%, but we're getting better and better every year.
Well, that's part of the fun of it, I think, is like you never reach perfection. It's like the more you learn, the more you realize you have to learn.
Yes.
And as a farmer, you have the overlay of every year being different. And, you know, you've got weather and you've got water and you've got temperature and they're never predictable. They're
no.
always going to just do whatever. So it's like the ultimate artistry to coax, you know, food out of the land against all those different variables.
Well, and also I want to start talking about the drought a little bit.
Yeah, let's do it.
I'm really have been concerned about this drought.
Yeah.
I've got friends but we buy some we can't grow rice in Idaho, so we go to northern part of California, and we got some family farms that grow. They've been 44 years organic farming in rice. Mm-hmm. Really good people.
Yeah.
And so we source from them. And because of Lake Shasta and Lake Orville.
They're so low.
And so there's only going to be 25% of the acres planted this year into rice.
Wow.
And they've had a freeze, you know, had some almonds get burnt and some olive trees. And so they're dealing with some damage there. They don't know what that looks like yet.
25%.
Yes.
Is significant.
It's significant. And I have guys call me farmers from all over the country, you know, and in Oregon and what have you, and say, we don't have any water in a reservoir. And, mm-hmm. you know, Hollister, that's south of Twin Falls, it's on the salmon track. You know, they only got that 30 days of water. So they're just going to water their existing alfalfa that's established, and then they're going to collect insurance. And so they can't plant another crop that might, you know,
that's
do something.
Gamble.
It's a gamble. And so, you know, so that's out of production. You got the rice that's gone or whatever. And then I have friends in the Nebraska, and they had a really dry winter.
Oh, yeah.
But they're pulling out of the Okolala Aquifer, which is okay, which, you know, is a saving grace. But we all know that Okolala Aquifer is going to, there's too many straws in it.
Yeah.
And I was down in Lubbock, Texas in Amarillo, and I was talking to some farmers down there. And I asked them, I go, how long do you think you're going to be able to be able to farm with, you know, their water out of the ground? And he goes, man, if we got 8 years, I'll be surprised. They were putting in drip systems and trying to do every conservation program they could to try to stay there. And, you know, that's why I'm a big fan of this cover crop and what Gabe Brown's doing, because he's educating the masses.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really getting these, and these farmers are paying attention, because the truth is, if we can build that the soil profile and the the organic matter and get that soil and the aggregates in the soil to where it holds that moisture.
Get that rhizosphere beefed up.
Exactly.
So it's creating its own ecosystem stability.
Exactly.
It's a game changer.
Well, if they have three less irrigations a year because they can hold that extra water in the profile, it just makes things stretch a little bit further. Yeah. And so I think that's a game changer, and I think that cover cropping is the answer, and trying to figure out the no-till organic way. Now, here's the other thing that I wanted to also talk about is there's people are confused about regenerative farming, organic farming, non-GMO, and what have you. And
I'd love to hear your lay it out for our listeners.
Let's lay it out. So the bottom line is majority of the regenerative farming, they are using chemicals. Because they're no-tilling and not disturbing that soil, they're coming in there with glyphosate, they're coming in with other chemicals. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now you have some people that have dialed in that are using the rye and smothering it, and they're able to use a lot less chemicals doing, whatever. But when you're organic farming in our world, from my experience up to this point, and we are experimenting all the time. You know, I'm right now got a little experiment going on with a small acreage of a black medic, which is a micro clover that only gets about 4 inches tall, and it gets as thick as a hair on a dog's back. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a nitrogen fixing, right?
Yeah, nice.
So our thought is if we can get that really thick and we can go in there no-till and then be able to put that corn in there or some beans or whatever, then that will choke those weeds, still fix the nitrogen, whatever. Yeah. So this is something we're working on right now.
That's cool stuff. So that would come in as an annual.
It's an annual.
And then you just leave it there and you just direct drill your corn seed right in on top of that.
Yeah.
Leaving that soil all intact.
Now
it's kind of charged up with the nutrients. And then you're not needing to go in and disrupt the soil there.
Right.
That's cool, because if you can figure that out, this organic regenerative, like you said, that space in between the two still has a lot of pioneering technology and thought and practice and tools.
Right.
It's like a renaissance.
Well, and I think AI technology and camera technology is getting so good. And this is another thing I wanted to bring up is that everything's there. We got these color sorters that can do, 12,000 pounds an hour.
Oh yeah.
You know, coming through these cameras that, we see a defect, it'll blow it out. Boom, And so the bottom line is them same camera technology. And I go to these food shows and I see these robots move so fast it'll move a ping pong ball in 7 locations in a blink of an eye. Wow. That you're gonna be able to take a Cybertruck or a Ford Lightning, let's say, with a sliding camper shell type thing that's got these wings on it that's 30 foot in the back. This is an example. You know, it could be a tractor, whatever.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is that day's coming to where you're going to be able to put that Roomba out in that field and let it go day and night.
Right.
And cruise at...
And it's going to have some sort of intelligence where...
So it's going to be able to monitor that plant and say, okay, you got a disease here, or you got a bunch of aphid. Let's go out there and release a bunch of lace wings and ladybugs in that region.
Right.
And then instead of using...
pesticides.
Yeah, the pesticides and all that it's going to be able to monitor the crop as it goes.
Imagine the data collection alone. I mean, just what we could learn about the intricacies of plant growth and predatory cycling and with the insects and weather, suddenly if you had all of that live data continuously collected.
Right.
I mean, it would actually probably impact some of the study of farming from a really, scientific level.
From
a research level.
Yeah.
So take care of some of the problems while it's at it. That could be a pretty powerful tool.
Exactly. And the thing is, I want to go back to, in Germany, they do an extensive study. They take women's breast milk and they take a fat cell, to pull a sample of a fat cell and they take it and have it analyzed. They'll take it from here and take it over there and they'll put it to this lab and the Scotch guard from your carpets and upholstery to household chemicals to pesticides, insecticides.
Yes. Everywhere.
And it's showing up in that fat cell and that we're holding on to that toxicity. And so the bottom line is, farmers and I have this heated discussion that, we can't feed the world organically, but, and they are not incorrect right now. But if we can jump in a Tesla car and self-drive itself across the United States without touching the wheel, I'm pretty sure that we can go over a field of 8, 12 rows at a mile and a half an hour and be able to weed that thing
that's a very good point.
And identify the weed at a two-leaf stage and say, this is a morning glory, this is a nightshade, this is a lamb's quarter, this is, you know, redwood or what have you, and a cockabur, and it's going to say, okay, you're gone, but yet we're going to leave a micro clover and a pea that's going to fix a nitrogen so we can have multi-diversity in this crop. And so this technology...
That makes it harder for those weeds to get established and
exactly.
entrenched anyhow. Like, suddenly they're competing with not only your crop for space, but with those cover crops, and it's
well. And then we don't. And then there's no excuse for the GMOs, you know. And I know the Bayer bought Monsanto, and they, you know, they make the pharmaceutical drug, and they make a chemical, and they own the seed patents, and they own the whole integrated deal.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of money in keeping you barely alive, and that's what they, you know, this is what it looks like to me.
Yeah, chemically dependent food system will make a chemically dependent population, and that's really good for profits.
Well, they're going to fight, you know, because there's a lot of money in cancer, what they make in cancer. You know, no, they're not going to have a cure because there's too much, there's billions and billions of dollars made in that. And so the bottom line is, people that are educated or listen to podcasts like this are going to say, okay, you know, I'm going to eat clean, I'm going to exercise, you know, and handle stress. It's you know, there's it's all about a balance in life, and it's all the components put together. And so I think that, and this makes me optimistic for the future of farming, because I think that you can get a kid that has not wanted to come back to the family farm because the farmers are getting old.
Yeah, I mean, the average age of farmers in America is, I think, 60.
Yeah, and so the kids don't really want to come back because it's a lot of work, and then they, and up to this point, they're just not making enough money. But I think if they could get into this kind of new farming, knew they're making a difference.
Yeah,
and it was profitable.
And they have purpose. I mean, you look at the Great Resignation. It's not about money anymore. It's about purpose.
Exactly. And my biggest, and here's one of my concerns that I have, and we talked about this before, is these hedge funds are buying a lot of this farmland. Bill Gates has bought 300,000 acres of farmland. And and I got some Mennonite friends in Mississippi, and Oprah Winfrey and Bill Gates bought that farm in their whatever they call their hedge fund. But
wild
anyway, so they're not happy about it. They don't want a farm for them. And they'd rather own their own land.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And so, but these hedge funds have come in and offered so much more. They're out competing their local farmer. He can't afford to buy it.
Yeah.
So what I don't like the idea of is the fact is that these hedge funds own all the farmland, and they're coming to the farmer and say, well, you farm it, you're going to pay me 5%. We're going to pay too much for it. You're going to give us $600 an acre rent. Then all of a sudden, it's like all these corporations that own all these apartment complexes, and they keep upping their rent from 1500 to 1800 to 2100. And then you, you know, and so
system.
Well, all of a sudden we're all a bunch of serfs, right?
Yep.
And so we got,
you have no control over your farming techniques.
Absolutely not.
I hear this from a lot of farmers.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I want to grow for you, and we're going to minimize any chemicals. We're going to go full regenerative. That's our goal, is to be as close to organic as possible regenerative, but my landlords won't give me permission.
That's correct.
And then the county's going to dock us, and then we can't get crop insurance because they say if you plant millet,
right,
that you lose your crop insurance on your other crops.
Yeah, that's correct.
Because you're leaving that two crop rotation, or, you know, one crop in a fallow. And I think people underestimate the power that these big systems, including privatization of farmlands by non-farmers, is going to, it could radically reshape our farming in a bad way.
Yes.
Yeah. It's scary. Have you heard any stats about, like, how much farmland has been bought out by these guys?
No, I don't have that.
My buddy Don has some really good stats. I'll reach out to him, and we can post a link in the show notes about it, because he's in Eastern Washington and keeps up a lot on the stats and whatnot. And it is pretty scary, you know?
Yeah, but you know, I tell you what I do believe. I'm optimistic for the future of farming. And there's a lot of kids in FFA. We got some kids that I've got to know that are in FFA, and they're excited. And I think, given the opportunity, and, you know, we've even talked about it, you know, having some farm classes and workshops to get these kids, you know, out in the fields, and and saying, this is what we do, this is why we do it, and then get them energized. You know, it takes a lot of capital to farm, you know, the equipment and all that. And so that's what's going to
get started.
there's no way they're going to be able to start from scratch unless their grandfather's in it, but at least they have the interest to maybe go to the grandfather's farm or their dad's farm and maybe want to be involved.
What about people who are going to be wanting to come into farming and have no family legacy in it at all? Like these urban folks that are wanting to, I mean, do you see any sort of partnership that could happen between like a farming legacy, like family that has the land, has the equipment, doesn't have any grandkids that want to farm, but then you meet some people from wherever, whatever they grow, Boise or Seattle or heck, LA, I don't know. Like, what do you see that we could creatively do to try to foster like a new generation of farmers?
I think that, for the kids that don't have the resource of the land, I think the future for them is aquaponics and greenhouse technology. You know, they got to call it a Winnipeg, or it's like an underground greenhouse. You go down about 12 feet deep, 40 foot wide, whatever. And so you've got the ground is keeping you cool during the summer, but it's also keeping you warm in the winter. And then you're feeding the fish, and then you're feeding these vegetables. And so it's so less capital intensive.
Yeah.
And that right there, I think, is a future.
Perfect for servicing urban areas, because then they are getting fresh food right there instead of growing it in California and shipping it to Boston.
Well, you're also your own ecosystem. So once you got that water self-contained, that water is recycling itself because the fish are feeding it, and then they've got... and then it comes through, cycles through, and then it goes back through, and the plants filter the water. And,
so fascinating.
Yeah, and you're just adding like maybe 20 gallons a day or 100 gallons a day, which is not very much water.
Really efficient when you think about it.
When you think about it. So you're your own ecosystem.
Yeah.
And that technology is going to get better and better as well. I've got a friend that's very knowledgeable in it, and he puts a few workshops out there, and I think that's going to be a great potential for kids that don't, you know, because you got to have millions of dollars to get in the game.
Yeah.
And
something like that. I mean, it's like it's a business model that you can present that could theoretically get some financing behind it to build it, you know, and it's not like you're proposing to go buy, you know, 3,000 acres of farmland.
Well, and then so, and so the USDA has programs that will, the kids could go to and get a system that's already engineered, designed, and they'll help fund it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's a lot of positive things coming, and we gotta get kids educated, get them motivated,
and you know, really getting kids to understand the role of food in health. I think there's a whole new generation of kids that don't buy it. You know, this younger generation, I feel like they're much more skeptical of foods and what's in it and the effect they have on their health. And it'll be fascinating to see how this farm at food is medicine movement, you know, soil health, human health connection develops with this next generation. That's, you know, I just feel like they're a little bit more susceptible to the message, where other people are like, oh, you know, food can't ever be medicine. What are you talking about? You know, you eat your food and then you go take your prescriptions. That's how it works.
Yes.
And I feel like that generation's kind of like, well, that's kind of BS. Like, why does it have to be that way? You know? And, but you know, I just think they have a different way of looking at it.
Well, they're absolutely correct. And I'll tell you what, this Dr. William Lee, he has done some cancer research and gone into the food. And he's like going in here, like when you eat, like we have this Barley Max. It's a cereal that's good for gut health.
Mm-hmm.
And we got oatmeal and stuff like that. Well, the properties of barley actually builds new blood cells. Research shows that when you eat blueberries and strawberries and that, you know, and then when you have the cacao bean, which is a cocoa bean, and that's, we're putting some of that in our meal replacement bar, it actually shrinks tumors.
Yeah,
and
that's
so
amazing.
And so I highly recommend people download, he does a TED Talk, and research Dr. William Lee. And it really truly is, it's been since the beginning of time that, you know, food is our medicine.
Yeah.
And that's how you get your nutrients. And until we get our soil back to health, to get our nutrients and our minerals and all our stuff back into our body, because that's the only way you can really truly absorb it is through your food.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so
it's those complexes that our bodies are designed to digest and assimilate. And, you know, it's the micros and the macros are distorted in our food system. We don't have the minerals. It's usually really high in carb, really low in, you know, other things like high in omega-6, low in omega-3. Like there's a lot of those kind of things. But then what a lot of times I feel is overlooked is you think about all the other compounds that are present in really high quality raised foods that are not things that we measure. They're maybe not even things we understand. And they could be the anti-cancer compound that everybody's been looking for. But here it was just present in our food this whole time. But when we switch to this mass commodity, chemically intensive farming method, we coaxed those like secondary metabolites out of the plant because it was too stressed, or maybe it needed another relationship with another plant to create that compound in the first place. It's a really fascinating thing. And I feel like once we make a shift of exploration, and this is what I did in my first career because I was an ethnobotanist. You take foods, you take medicinal plants, you look for chemicals that affect physiology, like anti-cancer, anti-stroke, anti, you know, whatever, anti-diabetic. And there is like a whole new world of research out there waiting that we haven't even started to scratch the surface. Like there's hundreds of thousands of those compounds. We only know what 1% of them are.
That's right.
It's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah.
I know. Barley's a cool crop. I'd like you to tell our listeners a little more about the crops you guys grow and why and how you got those crops in the first place. Like, you guys grow some awesome corn.
Yeah, we got some corn that we have an Abenaki corn that was the first corn that the Indians and the Pilgrims ate together during Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm, and then we have a Hopi corn that that's an ancient corn, goes back thousands of years. And that's what's interesting about those two varieties is that the bees love them. They have a lot of flavor.
Yeah.
And then we have four different varieties of beans, and then we got the rice, and then we got the purple barley, which is from Tibet, and then the barley max, it's for the gut health, that's really popular and have amazing success in Australia, and that's where that came from.
Yeah,
and we're growing it in Idaho. We got the oatmeal, and so, and then we're trying to get ready to eat, because people are on a fast-paced move, but the other thing I wanted to bring up is that when they buy food from us, and we mail to the door, you know, Thousand Springs Mill, and we have 1,000 springs to feed our farm. That's why we're 1000 Springs Mill.
Amazing, yeah.
Is we can mail to your door, and we also, because we work with, go in the retail stores in East Coast, West Coast, and through the country, we've also set up a fundraising program to keep the revenue in the communities, and so that kids get to keep 15% of sales.
Yeah.
And so the... And you just got to just go on the website, hit it.
Yeah, see, this is such a cool program. I think if our listeners hear this, they're going to be like, what? We had no idea that this was out here. Like, what a cool concept. So for our listeners, you know, you can go to Tim's and Kurt's website, the Thousand Springs Mills, and say your kids are going to the Montessori school down the street, just for example. And they're always looking for great fundraisers. You can partner with these guys and create a code so that all of the family and loved ones of your students can share this code, and a certain percentage of the proceeds will forever kick back to support their school program, as long as you're enjoying beans and popcorn and oatmeal and barley. I mean, it's staples. It's things that we eat every day.
Yeah.
To me, this is a no-brainer.
Like, well, you're putting healthy food in your pantry. You're feeding kids healthy, and then it's all organic, of course. And the other thing is, you're instead of giving the money to the corporations in Chicago and New York or whatever, that money stays in the community, and so we mail right to the door. It's on auto. You can do auto read auto. We're adding coffee. We're adding some other things to that, because that way you can get your coffee, your tea,
staples,
and your basic staples. And so that way, when it just comes to your door, auto reorder, and then that you keep that money in the community, and it builds wealth. And with this inflation the way it is, you know, helps mom do more sports and lets that program pay for it.
Yeah.
And also, when you look at the unit, the servings, you know, you're at, I think it was like 23 cents a serving, 30 cents a serving.
Jeez.
You know, here you go out to eat and it costs $80. But if you cook in the Instapot or Crock-Pot, it takes you 15 minutes to throw in 4 cups of water and a half cup of beans and rice and wheat berries and purple barley or whatever. And you throw it in there, hit the button.
Yeah.
And you come back and the house smells good.
Yeah.
And you have this healthy, good food, and you fed everybody for $1 a piece. It's like $4 versus if you took them to town, it would be $80.
It's a no-brainer.
And
now that they even make it so much simpler at grocery stores, where if you really are in such a pinch, which I get, I mean, you're like me, we work. How many hours a week?
Oh, yeah.
80. And, you know, so you run in and our local Whole Foods store and our local like Albertsons has this, where everything's prepped and cut up. Like there's onion, celery, carrots, like everything you need. So if you're really in a hurry, like we'll do that and throw it in the Instapot and boom, you're eating in an hour and a half.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Well, and it just, you just feel good when you eat it.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. Real food makes you feel real good. And that's it. That is just the truth. And you know, here I've been on, I'm down here in Southern Idaho right now. I'm away from home. So I've been on the road and eating out more in restaurants. And I tell you, I've kind of hit a wall after 3 days where I'm like, I'm going to go to the co-op and I'm making dinner tonight at my girlfriend's house because I can't eat another meal out in a restaurant. I just, it's good. But after a while, it really makes you feel pretty crummy. So I understand what you're saying. But, you know, I before we stop talking, though, if you don't mind us kind of going back to this concept of cancer belts and agriculture and really how our culture has made, has created a very at-risk population in our rural areas that is seeing epidemic levels of neurological diseases like Parkinson's, MS. And the last recording I did in the studio was with a dear friend of mine, Dr. Travis Denton, who's a, he's a medicinal chemist, and he knows his stuff. He knows his stuff. And he is an expert in MS and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and all these things and studying how the brain is reacting. And there is very clearly a connection with exposure to pesticides, exposure to farming chemicals, and poor quality food. Like, when do you think rural populations of people are going to stand up and say, okay, this is a thing? You know, we're down at the Grange Hall, if that even still happens anymore, then most of those have closed up over the last couple decades. But you start looking around when you're at church or at a community potluck or picnic, and you're like, okay, how many of us have lost a parent to one of these types of diseases? It's like 80%.
Yes. Yeah, and I can't remember if I touched on this earlier or not. I can't remember, but you know, my father died of he had Parkinson's and then got cancer, and it was I think his chemicals was he was a chemical farmer.
And your son?
So my son, yeah, he got tuberous sclerosis, and he was tipping over with seizures at the age of three, and then we went and got, you know, found out that he's got these benign tubers. Yeah. It's what's called tuberous sclerosis. It's like tubers in a potato, and it was growing next to the brain and one behind the eye and whatever. And then, you know, we had neighbor up the road got pancreatic cancer. You know, he's a young guy at 42.
Oh, it's just awful.
And then you go out there and you see the planes flying in the fields with, you know, Laura's Band and insecticides and whatever. And
are people making the connection in your community?
You know, they, I've had guys that at first, you know, I think they were mocking me because I'm going against the grain of the traditional farming and what have you. And gave me a lot of grief, but when their spouse died, I got cancer or died or whatever, they say, you know what, you're on to something.
Yeah.
And so they're starting to pay attention, and we're going to get more farmers. And, you know, we pay a premium, you know. Organic farming is
it's premium.
You know, you have to pay a little extra for it, but it's worth it. We spend quite a bit of money organic farming. And so,
you know, honestly, I really just wonder when these rural communities, and I know how hard it is because I've spent my life out on farms periodically. I grew up, you know, farming and grew up with a backpacker Roundup just, you know, by default. I also had some really weird health issues that I think are probably directly related to that. But still, I run up against this pushback from people. Like I was talking to a farmer's wife at a conference a few months ago, and she's really, you know, nice lady. And we're just talking, and all of a sudden out of left field, she's like, you know, I just have to say, I love Roundup. And I was like, okay, so where are you going with this? I spray it whenever I get the chance because I think it's great stuff. And I'm like, okay, so I know you're kind of trying to goad me here, but I'm like, let's go there. Like, let's really talk about this because, you know, why are you defensive of Roundup being looked at through with some skepticism as far as public health is concerned? And she's like, I just think it's been villainized. I'm like, okay, well, fair enough. Let's talk about that. But, you know, it was fascinating to me that she's a farmer, but I'm a nurse, you know, and I found it really odd to be arguing and at odds with someone who's trying to tell me that something's perfectly safe, but they've hardly ever set foot in a hospital unless they were there to see a loved one.
Right.
And at the end of the conversation, I just had to say, look, you know, we can agree to disagree, but I spent thousands of hours in healthcare and, you know, did everything, mostly ICU, ER, but I spent some time in hospice. I spent some time in oncology. And I can honestly tell you from experience that the rural areas get hit harder.
Yeah, they do.
With a lot of these things, cancer, definitely, but, you know, all these Parkinson's and neurological. And she was like, well, I just don't see that as being true. So how do we present more data to our rural populations to kind of warm them up to the idea that there is some substantial data there that indicates that these cancer belts are directly related to the farming practices that they're defending so hard.
Yeah. And, you know, some people just, they believe in a cause, or, you know, they get caught into this routine and they accept that that's normal. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's just no question about it. You know, they're finding glyphosate that attaches to the water molecule.
Yeah.
They're finding it in places it does not belong.
Like in Antarctica.
Yes. And
how
so,
in the heck did it get down to Antarctica?
Yeah. So it's
they're not spraying weeds down there.
No.
I guarantee it.
No, it's not. And so we just, you know, in China, they, I don't know how many billions of gallons of that stuff they make, but you know, it's just that, and Mother Nature adjust for itself. You know, we got Roundup resistant weeds. We kept spraying, you know, the soybeans, the corn,
yeah,
the alfalfa, and
they're
back to back, and all of a sudden the weeds go, you know what, I'm just going to change my biology, and I'll just, and then they're resistant, and then the system got abused,
then they're super bugs and super weeds.
Yeah. And you know, we've done the antibiotics with humans too, and overdone it, and to where, you know, people got MRSA or they got staph and they can't fight it because you know,
they don't have anything to throw at it.
They can't throw anything at it because
nature's smart.
Nature, you know, it is. And so the bottom line is we got to work with Mother Nature.
Yeah.
You know, we got to do it holistically, naturally. Mm-hmm. And so, and it can be done. And I see huge, like I say, technology changes coming in the next 5 years. It's going to make this thing very appealing for young kids that want to get back in.
Yeah. And a huge opportunity from a business perspective.
Yes.
I think when you're trying to do the right thing and you're trying to be altruistic with your business, there's a certain segment of people that love to roll their eyes and kind of be like, okay, have fun with that. That's not legitimate business.
Yeah.
It's for good business. But when you think about it purely from an economic standpoint and a business opportunity standpoint, when you look at what's coming at us, like that, this is an undeniably huge opportunity for people.
Yeah.
That will be very viable and will probably help support thousands of families in America to make a living making the world a better place.
Absolutely.
And to me, that's like super hopeful.
No, I agree with you 100%.
I think it's super cool. So I just am appreciative that you've taken the time to hang with me today.
Yeah.
It's always fun. Tim's a riot. If you ever have a chance to pop in and meet him in person or see the farm is absolutely spectacular. I'm very lucky to have gotten a pretty cool tour. It's in a kind of an undiscovered part of Idaho as well. So if you're ever in the area, or look it up and enjoy that scenery online. So Tim, thanks for joining us. I love it.
And I love your passion and I love what you're doing. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us on the Regenerative by Design podcast. If you would like to learn more about the principles of regenerative food systems and agriculture, please see the show notes for links to education, a glossary, and guest information. This podcast was brought to you by Snacktivist Inc., a leader in the regenerative food industry. We create delicious foods from regenerative ingredients that are soil-focused, minimize water use, and maximize carbon sequestration, all while radically impacting human nutrition. Learn more about our work at snacktivistfoods.com.